Fire in the hole.
Planet Earth, an age of abundance. It's an era of entertainment in which mankind suffers from a loss of direction and a paralyzing plethora of leisure choices. Only the Vox Duo can navigate the deluge of delight that is the Golden Age.
Why, hello, Adam.
Joe, I'm hearing a double track, like the music is still going.
You don't happen to have the live stream open in your browser, do you?
Oh, that's exactly what's going on. What a dope. Oh.
And right away, we open up the show with a demonstration of exactly how technically competent we might not be.
Yeah, so if there was any doubt, you know, if you had this crazy conspiracy theory that I was the technical expert and Joe was simply riding my coattails, I think I pretty much put pay to that in today's prologue.
It's an easy mistake to make.
I'm going to pretend that didn't even happen and force you to edit it out later. Joe, don't... It's you! We need to stop meeting like this. People will talk. They'll say we're doing a podcast.
And the worst of it is, they might be right. Our secret shame revealed to the world.
Yeah, you know, everyone has their little ways of quietly dealing with life. And this is ours.
When in doubt, find some entertainment and then talk about it.
Sometimes, you know, my normal embarrassing geeky proclivities aren't enough. I need to actually, you know, go whole hog. And so this past weekend, I perhaps indulged myself far more than I normally would. And consequently, do we have a discussion for you? This is the DragonCon episode.
Did you get drunk on the experience, Adam? Are you suffering from a DragonCon-related hangover?
Joe. You know as well as I do that my drunk experiences are all 100% from alcohol. Anyhow. So we are going to talk today, because I went to DragonCon. We got some entertainment news, and you've been watching one of the brand new shows out on the streaming services. Which one is this?
Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan. And yes, that is the full name of the show.
Hot dog. But first, actually, shall we start with the entertainment news? Just get that stuff out of the way, though.
Oh, why not? Let's start with the entertainment news. What do you want to tell me about True Detective?
Okay, so I was actually surprised by this. I don't know, I kind of kissed it goodbye, but it turns out True Detective is getting a third season in January. True Detective, in case you're not clued in, is a police procedural series on HBO, is the best way to put it without spoilers. And the part of the fun concept is that each season tells a full story, but features an entirely different cast. And the only continuity is the series creator and writer, Nick Pizzolatto. I think I got that right. Pizzolatto? Pizzolatto. Nick Pizzolatto. There you go. If you say it with an Italian accent, you figure it out. Season one is rightly regarded as stupendous. Season two was something the cat dragged in, which I personally find a little hyperbolic. People love to have extreme emotions about things. It is easy to see why the quality level would have come down. You know, the creator writes a novel, decides it would be a better TV show, shops that around, gets a deal, writes the whole 500-page script. It does great. And then immediately the studio head say, "Hey, that was great. What do you got for us next season?" You know, it's second novel syndrome.
And unless you're Brandon Sanderson, you can't just turn out a 500-page novel overnight.
Exactly. You know, I think, in truth, this was always a little bit doomed. But this time, Pizzolatto took his sweet time. Season 1 was in 2014, Season 2 in mid-2015, and this one's going to debut in January of 2019. So, you know, he's had time to work on this. I'm bullish.
Yeah, depending on when they started production, that's a good two and a half years of preparation before actually diving into it. So I would expect a better story.
Yeah, and once again, it's chosen an interesting locale. Season 2 went to California, you know, which is just like, yeah, all right. But this one's set in Appalachians and is starring Mahershala Ali, which you wouldn't think I'd have trouble saying that, considering I grew up reading the Bible and Mahershala Hashbaz is one of the kings.
I'm impressed you remember that.
Hey, man, I haven't forgotten that much.
And anyway, you know, if you're wondering who Mahershala Ali is, you may remember him as Cottonmouth on season one of Luke Cage, unless I am drastically getting my memory of names wrong.
No, you wouldn't be forgetting. You wouldn't be getting your names wrong. It's just that's kind of the sad thing to know him from.
I don't get out much, so we got to go with what we got.
Mahershala Ali. You may remember as the Oscar-winning actor from Moonlight, which won Best Picture that year that they actually cocked up and said some other movie's name first.
Yes, that infamous year. I do remember there was a bit of a kerfuffle over that.
Mm-hmm. So, you haven't seen season one yet. It's recommended, but for those of you who have caught up, be on the lookout for this one. I think it's going to be good.
You know, it strikes me if I do want to dive into True Detective, I can watch season one, and because each season is a distinct story without continuity, I can just skip season two and go straight into season three.
Yeah, that's entirely true. and you know, that's just part of the glory of it. I love this new way of doing things, you know, where a whole season is a standalone story. Obviously, the British have already cottoned to it, but five season shows and like made me want to run for the hills. It's just such an investment. I've talked about this before.
And speaking of exposure to minority cultures, I think it's time for your report on DragonCon.
Yes, coming to you live after DragonCon, which is the impressive thing. A lot of people come in live. Some don't make it out. Yes, so my wife and I, for the first time, spent a full weekend at a comic book convention. DragonCon in Atlanta, which, you know, any and all geeks have probably heard of. We volunteered, because it was our first time and we were worried about being overwhelmed, what we did was we volunteered and manned the information desks because we thought it would be a great crash course in how the con works. And not only that, of course, it got us free badges, which is a not insignificant savings. And because DragonCon takes care of its volunteers, we also got free lunches and dinners. And there was this great little volunteer lounge where you could put your feet up. It was good. They did a really good job with all that. So with the exception of transportation to the convention and items we bought from vendors, the con was actually free for us. Now, DragonCon has, and this is what I've learned, and you know, this is all hearsay, but DragonCon has a very different character to most conventions. It's the largest fan-organized convention in America. So, and a lot of conventions, there's a lot more business done. You know, companies make big announcements and have panels, and a lot more actors kind of show up to do their promotional work. Whereas DragonCon is much more about fan panels and much more about cosplay and much more about just having a good time. Of course, this means that celebrities who do show up are that much more appreciated. My wife waited in line to see Mike Coulter of Luke Cage fame because she finds him dreamy, and of course I can't really argue. I mean, that man.
That man is what we all wish we looked like after we went to the gym.
Yes. Buff, tall, and black.
And bald doesn't hurt either.
Well, I used to be bald. Doesn't work for me, though. My head is shaped like a ball, so I need that extra hair on the top of my head to just kind of shape my face into something resembling a human. So that's DragonCon. And it was really cool. You know, I mean, I've heard and read about conventions for so very long, and yet somehow I'd never been to one. There was this moment at the food court where I was having lunch with some of the people I know who also went to DragonCon. And the Trekkie among us, because you were not there, Joe, was holding forth on the pilot episode of the original series. And at one point, he couldn't come up with a detail and just kind of waved it off. Whereupon, someone from a nearby table called it out to him, causing the occupant of a third table to add some other piece of vital commentary. And I thought to myself, yes, this is a convention.
And that's actually, and this is something I think I wanted to ask you about. Stuff like that is what makes me wonder how much I would truly enjoy a conventioner, because I think I would always feel that I didn't quite fit in, and that I have a wide range of interests, but I would say, when you get right down to it, my knowledge of geek stuff is a mile wide and an inch deep. And I feel like at Dragon Con or any con, I'd constantly be running up with the diehards who can tell you the details of what aired on Doctor Who in 1976 and which actor was doing it and what specific serial it was in. And I feel like even though I am a nerd, I would feel out of place at a con. I would feel a bit of an imposter.
So here's something interesting. Apparently, there were some sociology students who did a study at a convention. And what they did was they recorded, I want to say, lingual movements, not because that was what was in there, what I remember reading, but that's what I remember writing about back when I was ghosting people's master's theses. But just this idea of tracking what topics people bring up first in writing or how they kind of construct their rhetorical arguments. And an introduction, in many ways, is a rhetorical argument. You know, this is who I am, your five-paragraph essay that you always had to write in school. And they found that among geeks at conventions, one of the very first movements was always saying they don't feel like they're like other geeks.
So in other words, you're saying I fit in perfectly.
Exactly.
Well, there you go.
I wouldn't worry so much. Plus, just based on the fact that every time I have a question, you can answer it, I think you'd probably do fine. I understand. And I've been kind of, you know, with one toe in the comics world for a while, it occurred to me that a good 5 or 10 years have passed since I was on the up with every development in the Marvel universe. And that's a very long time. Like, there's so much stuff I don't know anymore. But I digress. I wanted to get the full flavor, not only for my benefit, but for yours, Joe, because we've talked before about the possibility of you coming down to Atlanta and us doing this whole convention thing together.
We have.
So, of course, you know, every step I took, every panel, every vendor, otherwise, I thought I had to think to myself, not only am I enjoying myself, but also, would Joe enjoy this?
And yet, you're within touching distance of Peter Capaldi, and you don't bring me a selfie.
Well, he was moving, you know, at least a bit of a decent speed. I don't know, maybe I had time to get out the camera and shove it in his face. Would you like the picture of Capaldi's surprised eyeballs?
or maybe drawn back fist?
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe just the fixed fist of his handler, who, to be sure, was just another Dragon Con volunteer like me. Not exactly intimidating. So I went to a few panels. I checked out the cosplay. I summoned up my personal reserve of bravery and talked to a few pros that I had long admired. And walking through that, the panels were kind of interesting. I think Anna made the right choices. She went to celebrity and based ones, you know, and saw a couple of famous people, which she had to wait in some serious lines to do. Whereas I went for the writing and self-publishing track more and listened to people hold forth on the realities of the market and tips and tricks and this and that. my benefit, of course, was that everyone wanted to go to Anna's panels, and nobody really wanted to go to mine. So I could just walk into any of my panels, even if I was 5 minutes late. It wasn't a problem. No one cares.
They were probably glad to have you show up.
Exactly. You saw all of their eyes brighten just a little bit at the realization that they had that much more attention. And no, everything was decently populated. When you have, what, 85,000 people, there's something for everyone. And so a fair number of people were in every panel. I also went to a Sensate panel, which was my only real fan panel. You know, where fans are up there on stage, Uber fans, if you will, or whoever the heck they could get instead of celebrities or particular authorities. That was interesting. You know, it's just people talking about their love of it, but there's no particular insight. It's just a room to be in with other people who you know like what you do.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure that appeals to me. I don't know. Maybe it's just my antisocial behavior or something. But it was a decent discussion. The cosplay, of course, was immensely impressive. Have you seen the movie Alien?
Yes. Well, we are talking the one about Ripley and the actual alien, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Right, the xenomorph.
Yep.
Yeah, there's a woman there who was cosplaying as Ripley, but she had also built that big yellow construction mech.
Wow.
That Ripley walks around in. And this thing walked around the convention floor, which probably caused a little bit of traffic problems. And I saw her dismantle it afterwards. You know, she could take off the arms and then kind of just take it piece by piece, her and her assistants. But anyway, this thing was functional. Amazing. Perhaps more fun and also very apropos, there was a person cosplaying as Tony Stark. And behind him was the Hulkbuster armor, also moving around.
Nice.
So that was really cool. Although I think my favorites may just be dead-on renditions of the characters. Some people just successfully achieve this like-a-look level that is just supremely amazing. You may have seen my pictures on Facebook.
I did. I was particularly struck by the individual who was cosplaying as Charlton Heston in The Ten Commandments.
Right?
I was thinking that was the one thing I did not expect to see at Dragon Con. Out of all of the cosplay opportunities, I would not have predicted that one.
Yeah, it's the people who think a little outside the box that are the most entertaining. Incidentally, while I was taking that picture, Jesus walked by and gave him the thumbs up.
You can depend on the nerds.
Yeah, he was a little hampered, though. Never bring a life-size cross to it. Convention. You always have to carry that stuff.
Yeah, it's probably about the middle of the day that you start regretting your costume and accessory choice.
Totally. The 12 stations of the cross at that point were the Marriott Marquis level. Anyway, but the best part, I don't know about you, but the best part for me was talking to the pros. And not only out of professional interest. And this, I guess, is the one thing I'd like to get across, or the one thing, if you asked me to just say one thing about the convention that I would talk about. I don't know if we've discussed this before, but every previous time, and there have only been a few, when I've gone out of my way to try to find, you know, a professional at a signing, someone big, like Dave Barry, who was my first autograph ever, or Mark Bagley, the penciler of Spider-Man since forever. Anyway, whenever I've gone, I've been disappointed. I've come back with my heart broken a little bit. And the reason why is because you build it up in your head, I guess. Because we all know what we want out of these things. What we want is just a few minutes to actually shoot the breeze.
Mm-hmm.
With these idols of ours. You know, pick their brains, ask them the questions we've always wanted to ask, but also just have a conversation and maybe even share a little bit about ourselves. and just, you know, relate to these people because we feel like we know them. After one or two times of trying that, of realizing, no, you're person 579 in line, and you just need to get your name signed and then move along, I realized that going to signings and the like was just not for me. I'm not a collector, and I don't really get a thrill out of just having my picture taken with somebody. So there you have it. But in the Artist Alley, in the pop art level, I went ahead to the Indie Comics panel. And after going to the Indie Comics panel, I went ahead and tracked down all of the people who were on it, as well as a few other people. And it was really cool meeting a few of them, because I'd actually been tracking their careers since they were amateurs. As I wrote on my Facebook post, there's this one guy, Eric Burnham, who is now the writer on Ghostbusters and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, who I read his fan fiction when I was in middle school.
Mm.
And he was a little older than me. He was in college by then, I think. And, you know, he was just writing Batman stories. And then later, in this crazy coincidence, he and his friends started publishing a black and white anthology book. And the first short story that was submitted that they actually accepted was mine.
Oh.
At a time when I was in college. And that appeared in the fourth out of their six or seven issues that lasted. They all used that as sort of a platform to get their name out of there, and then Eric Burnham moved on to better things. And so it was just weird how I'd kind of grown up and kind of kept intersecting with his name. And it was really cool to talk to him about that, because God knows, no one had ever asked him about his Batman fan fiction from when he was 19 years old.
Well, you always want to have the unique question when you're talking to a celebrity.
Yeah, right? And he was great. You know, we talked for 20 minutes, and my strategy was that I was always going to be polite and buy something at the table. That if I was going to take their time, I was always going to make a purchase and make it worth their while. So I spent about $60, I guess, at the convention on the vendor floor, and all of it was just buying small things like single issues or sketches or knickknacks of whatever sort.
This table you have here, what's the cheapest item on it? Can you point me to the cheapest item?
I mean, bluntly, yes, that's what I did. I didn't actually ask. That seems a little gauche, but my eyes always scanned the table, and I looked for something light that I could buy to stay within my budget. So Eric Burnham, and on the same level, Dirk Manning, who I remember he started publishing short 8-page comic book stories on his website a long time ago. But after he had, you know, dozens of them, he managed to start selling collections of them to Image Comics.
Mm.
And has moved on from there. So that's really cool. But my eye the whole time was on Gerhardt, who you may remember since I sent you my Cerebus collection a long time ago, is the background artist who suddenly shows up in issue 65. So about halfway through, not Church and State, but, or maybe the first volume of Church and State. Anyway, you know, and all of a sudden just takes this whole art level to another level.
You know, I didn't recognize the Dave Gerhardt name, but when I saw the photo, my mind did flash to Sims and Gerhardt. That jumped out at me from having looked at those trade paperbacks. So, yeah, I did recognize Gerhardt eventually as being involved with the Cerebus.
Yeah, he had a fascinating relationship with Dave Sim. Of course, anyone's relationship with Dave Sim is going to be fascinating because Dave Sim is weird. But he had a very unique partnership. You know, normally, as I explained to you a few episodes back, you have a penciler who does all the pencils for the comic, and then you have an inker, and maybe then you have a letterer. Not so in this case. Dave Sim would essentially figure out, you know, the vanishing points and whatnot, and just kind of plot out the page, and he would draw and ink and letter the page.
Oh, wow.
No, he would letter later, but he would, yeah, I mean, but ultimately he lettered. He would draw and ink the characters, and then after that, he would give the comic to Gerhard, who would just have the characters and the panels to work from. And then Gerhard would proceed to plot out and then pencil and ink in the backgrounds. And consequently, you know, you see in these later volumes of Cerebus, most of them, I guess, because he got in fairly early, you know, these gorgeously detailed backgrounds. And what more, all of them, you know, in fully realized universes, because he would create these models, you know, and plot out everything just so. And the result is just still some of the best art that the comics industry has ever seen. There is a pile of original Cerebus art on the table that I lusted after, of course, and a few of them were just establishing shots, like full-page splashes of establishing shots of a hotel or a field or something. And I thought to myself, my God, yeah, it doesn't have Cerebus in it or, you know, or any of the story points, but I would love to have that on my wall. It's beautiful. So long story short, he and his wife Shelley were wonderfully warm folks. I talked to him for, you know, a good 20 minutes. And even since Shelley turns out to be a biographical writer, she does a column in a local newspaper about famous figures. I passed along the secret that The Economist is the best obituaries in the business. And the whole thing was just magical for a fan. It was exactly what you want. And I concluded the time by purchasing a new children's book that Shelley wrote and Gerhard did the art for, that I will be reading to my little nephew in due time.
Oh, very cool.
Very cool. Yeah, that was the highlight for me. That was the best. So appreciate it, Gerhard. So I guess that's about all I really have to say off the cuff about Dragon Con. We're definitely going back next year. We're definitely going to do the volunteering thing again. And we'll probably mix it up and go to different panels and different features. Like, for example, maybe I'll take half a day and go to the gaming area and just let her rip. Try it, you know, because they have this whole huge hall where you go up to the desk and you can borrow any game with a deposit. And there's this big stack of games back there. So a lot of the new ones, a lot of the classics. They have the stuff that takes you 12 hours to play, and they have the stuff that'll be over in 20 minutes. And then you sit down with your friends and you have a good time. And incidentally, con culture here, but just based on my observations, people tend to go to conventions, and the old-timers, after X number of years, seem to wind up just paying the fee and then just meeting with their friends in the gaming area and never coming out. Like, that's how my brother-in-law, who's gone for, you know, probably a decade or two at least, always goes things. If you ever want to find him, he's in the gaming area. And so it was with another friend.
Yeah, you know, it's a good social opportunity when you put 85,000 people in one place.
Yeah, especially if there are people who fly in for this thing that you just haven't seen in a long time.
Right, it's one of those things you can actually get friends that you haven't seen for a while to travel for.
Right on. The only last point I'd make is that this does make me curious what a, quote, real, end quote, convention is like. I know some people up in Chicago, so if I were to try out a different kind, and I think I would probably want to go to Chicago Con, and you're fairly close to that, so that might be an optimal one for you to eventually venture out to with me.
Yeah, just 3 hours drive away.
Yeah, not so shabby at all. So that's the full report. Back to you, Joe.
Alrighty. Yeah, I think you've given me even more of an interest than I already had in attending Dragon Con or some other con someday. But I am not here to talk about that today. I am here to talk about my abiding junior high and high school interest, Tom Clancy, and specifically the Jack Ryan novels.
You know, this is an interest we share, although I don't know. I guess you must have had more of an interest if you remember it. Like, all I have are these vague impressions of what it was like to speed run through all the novels that Tom Clancy had out at the time. I can remember the names of some characters and the basic plots, maybe. You know, Jack Ryan, of course, Domingo Chavez, although I can't for the life of me remember the name of his father-in-law.
John Clark.
John Clark, thank you. Yes, John Clark. And, you know, this and that. It was all, I think I read it all too early, and consequently I was entertained, but didn't really understand half the time what was going on.
I can see that. I can see that, because they are very detailed novels that if you're not tracking with what's going on, a lot of it is going to just be a blur. And this is fun exactly. for me, because it's relevant again, as Amazon has put out a new show, rebooting the Jack Ryan character, this time in a TV show. So I saw it come up, and initially I wasn't planning to watch it, but the more I kept seeing it on the top of my Amazon screen, the more it became inevitable that, yes, I was going to end up watching this thing, because I simply enjoyed all of that stuff way too much when I was growing up to be able to completely pass it by now. These are stories that desperately need updating for today's world. I read them all when I was in high school in the mid-90s, and as is the case with most people, you read something and you don't necessarily pay attention to the publication date. It's new to you, so it's new. And it took me a while to realize that Hunt for Red October, which is perhaps Tom Clancy's best-known novel, had actually been published in 1984. Even when I was reading it, that was an old story. And all of these stories were written in a world where there was U.S., Russia, or not even Russia, U.S., Soviet Union competition and skullduggery back and forth. And these novels are very much of their time period. And I don't know how many people go back and read the old Tom Clancy novels now just because they take place in a world that is very, very alien to our own, with characters who have motivations that are perhaps a little bit confusing, worrying over things that are probably incomprehensible. You know, my daughter was actually reading a book recently that was about a character who was in the Soviet Union and had been sent to the Gulag, or sent to Siberia. And
my God, you've got your daughter reading Alexander Solzhenitsyn already? She's impressive.
If only. No, it was an age-appropriate book, but she was talking to us about it, and it was clear that what was going on in the story, 50% of it was passing her by, because she hasn't gotten to the point in school yet where they've taught history and have taught Soviet Union and have taught Russian secret police and all of that kind of stuff. So she was reading about something that was a very, very alien world, and it was causing a large chunk of the story to kind of go over her head in terms of what all of the actual implications and details were. And so Tom Clancy and Jack Ryan, if you just read the novels now, has that problem. It takes place in a very alien world and needs to be updated for the modern audience. And this show is basically Amazon taking what is a good and popular character and trying to reintroduce it to a new generation in a way that's actually relevant.
Okay, so I guess my first question is, I had a first question, and now I have an even an even firster question. I'm a writer, folks. Have you watched the whole first season? How many episodes have you seen?
I've seen 3 episodes at this point.
Okay. To your knowledge, are these adapted from any previously written storyline, or is this original?
This is original.
Okay. I was curious about that. Whether they might, you know, try to take the plot mechanics of one of the novels and try to do exactly that, to update it for future generations. Surely it couldn't be that difficult. The Russians are still the bad guys. You just couldn't refer to the president. There's this moment in Mission Impossible 6, I guess it is now. The one that just came out this summer, where someone says, "What does the president think of this?" And the other person says, "He's been advised." And you just, you just think to yourself, How did that go? How were they having this straight-faced? How you have to lampshade that or something. I don't know. Anyway.
Anyway. Yeah, so I wanted to, before I talk about what this show actually is, I want to talk about what drew me to the books and what I really enjoyed when I was younger, because I don't know if it matters at all to anybody else who's in the audience for this show, but it matters to me. It's part of who I consider the character to be in the world that these stories take place in. And so I think the thing to keep in mind if you're thinking about Tom Clancy and his novels were techno thrillers, and they built their reputation on the technology as much as they did on the thrill ride of the story. And you could actually learn quite a bit from these stories. And for me,
yes.
Hunt for Red October is the perfect example. And I'm going to risk boring the audience by geeking out a little bit over my love for the Hunt for Red October as a story. To briefly summarize for anyone who listens to this and is not familiar with the broad plot is that the Red October is a very high-tech Russian submarine, top-of-the-line, new in its class, using revolutionary technology, and it leaves port and disappears into the Atlantic Ocean. And shortly after it disappears into the Atlantic Ocean, the Soviet fleet goes on high alert, and pretty much every boat, plane, sub, ship, anything they have that floats is steaming out into the Atlantic Ocean in the general direction of the United States, which, as you might imagine, in the middle of the Cold War, puts the U.S. on, and in the entire NATO alliance, really, on super high alert. This looks like the precursor to an attack on the U.S. And CIA analyst Jack Ryan is in the thick of it, trying to figure out what's going on, what the motivations are, and what the correct response is. And the whole story is built around submarine technology. And it's built around the intricacies and the nuances of submarine propulsion systems and sonar tracking and motivations of characters in their respective worlds that they live in. And for me, what I loved about it was a thriller. It did move fast. There was a fair amount of tension in the book and in the story. But also, the book just had so many details about Soviet subs and U.S. subs. And Tom Clancy took the time to explain what was going on, and not just to throw around terms, but to really make you as the reader understand what this naval technology was and how it worked. And it's a book I've probably read at least three times by now, maybe more.
Wow.
And all the stuff in it, the technology in it, is just embedded in my brain. The Ohio-class nuclear submarines, the boomers, as they were called, that would go silent, would go deep, would disappear, and their job was not to move quickly around the ocean. Their job was to creep through the ocean at 5 knots and just become a black hole in the middle of the sea, disappear from view entirely, with the idea being that if nuclear war ever broke out, they could pop up at some random part of the Soviet coastline and launch their nuclear warheads. And the Soviets had their equivalent class of submarines. And then there was the Los Angeles class 688 fast attack subs. These were the hunters. Their job was to find the nuclear submarines, seek them out, and engage them and destroy them before they could launch the nuclear weapons. And I see.
You know what's really crazy? Let me cut you off there, because now you're getting into exactly what made Tom Clancy so interesting, of course, which is the nitty-gritty. I'm not the fan you are, but I do remember this. First of all, that Tom Clancy was essentially just a hobbyist. Mm-hmm. That all of this technical detail was coming from someone who worked at an insurance company, because he couldn't get into the military. He was myopic, I think. He had, yes. He had like
bottle glasses or something. So it's just stunning that this complete amateur was the person who wrote all this technical stuff. And second, the book you're talking about, I do remember this because, of course, I'm interested in nothing so much as stories of how writers get published, was that this book was published by the Naval Institute Press, that they were the ones who picked it up, the Naval Institute itself. And if it's good enough for the Naval Institute, then you know it's pretty legit.
And that was always something that came up during Tom Clancy's career, was how exactly he got his hands on as much technical information as he did. Some of the information he would give out about the subs, max cruising speed or maximum depth that they could go to in the water, was frankly guesses, but it was very, very educated guesses of a kind that had people who knew what the truth was wondering where exactly he was getting his info, because he wasn't always correct, but he was far closer to the truth than I think made a lot of military people really comfortable. And you always assume the other guy has probably figured out your secrets, but you really don't like seeing them actually go into print in a novel that sells a couple million copies.
Right.
But yeah, I learned so much from that book about how sonar works, you know, something that's stuck with me ever since. Cavitation, this idea that as the propeller is spinning in the water, there's a certain speed that the propeller can spin without generating too much turbulence. And as long as the propeller is spinning at that speed or slower, you're really, really quiet in the water. But as soon as you start to go over whatever that magic number is, and the magic number depends on the exact shape of the blades and the size of the blades and the type of material, but there's that magic number. As soon as you start spinning faster than that magic number, you start generating enough air bubbles in the water, and then those air bubbles start hitting the blade as it's spinning, and the air bubbles pop as they hit the blade, and that noise of the air bubbles generated by the blade impacting back against the blade and popping is cavitation. And that's what generates the sound that a sonar operator is listening for in the water, is that sound of cavitation. And so if you're an Ohio class sub, you know cavitation is almost literally death to you. You desperately avoid it. You go slow so that you can hide. But if you're an attack class sub, you accept a certain level of cavitation. It's just part of the price of doing business. But maybe you have to slow down so that you're not generating so much noise that you can't hear the other guy who's really, really quiet. Just so much detail about even how sound travels through the water, thermal inversion layers, where you've got a layer of colder water coming up from the depth and warmer water at the top, and sound kind of bounces off of this thermal layer that's there in the water. And so if you're underneath it, someone like, say, a sonar-equipped plane flying overhead isn't going to be able to detect you, because the noise of your engines or of your blades is kind of reflecting off of a layer of warmer water and protecting you. This book had so much detail, and it shouldn't have worked as a thriller. A book that has that much detail and teaches you, where the author actually has all of this exposition teaching you about technology, shouldn't work as a thriller, and yet somehow it did. That was the genius of Tom Clancy, was he could take this immense technical knowledge that he had as a hobbyist, and he could translate it into engaging, riveting stories that would keep you turning pages late into the night.
He would have been a great teacher, and I suppose in a manner of speaking, he was.
In a manner of speaking, he definitely was. So what was it about his books that really appealed to me? They were thrillers, but they had a heavy emphasis on brainy characters. Jack Ryan himself was a character who succeeded through smarts, quick wits, and guile. He wasn't toting around a submachine gun. He wasn't first in off of the Marine helicopter up. He was a guy who stood back, who looked at everything that was going on, noticed the tiny little details that other people didn't, and drew inferences and conclusions that seemed off the wall but were right more often than not. he was a smart character, and he's someone that if you're a nerd and not a jock, you can really identify with Jack Ryan in a way that you can't with other with a lot of other heroes of thrillers.
It's like heist movies, I guess. There is a great pleasure in seeing someone be clever.
Yes.
And that's what Jack Ryan always was. He was clever. The same reason you enjoy watching Thrawn work things out in his head while he's trying to beat the Star Wars characters and so forth.
Exactly. And that was what was great about Jack Ryan. He wasn't an action hero. He was a string puller. And he would go in the field when he needed to, if events were moving so fast that he basically had to be there to be watching what was going on and making decisions and reacting. So there was stuff that was happening out where there was a lot of action, but he wasn't a character that was his primary motivation. And he was always an interesting character in the stories, too. As I was going back and preparing for this show, I was refreshing my memory of who exactly he was and what exactly he did in the various novels. Well, let me describe it, and then we'll see what you think. He attended Boston College, had a Bachelor of Arts degree in economics with a strong minor in history. He was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. While he was waiting for his first assignment in the Marine Corps, he passed the Certified Public Accountant exam. So not only did he have a BA in economics, he also had gone through the full... Because economists aren't accountants. That's really two separate fields. So he had also learned everything he needed to know to become a CPA. Was serving in the Marines and had an unfortunate helicopter incident when he was about 23. When his helicopter crashed into, during a military exercise, badly injuring his back and kind of knocking him out of the service. But that's okay. As he was recovering in the hospital, he passed his stockbroker's exam, landed a position with a Wall Street investment firm, and started investing his own money as well as his clients' money, and ended up, by the time everything was all done, creating a net worth of $8 million for himself. Along the way, met his wife, who was ended up being a physician at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, left the accounting firm, enrolled at Georgetown University for 6 doctoral courses in history, at which point he obtained at least 1 history PhD, and then got a staff position teaching at the U.S. Naval Academy, before eventually being sent from the U.S. Naval Academy over to London to liaison with the Special Intelligence Service as kind of the CIA's representative in London with the SIS. It gets more ridiculous from there. And later in the stories, he becomes National Security Advisor and then eventually President. So he has what most people would consider to be a meteoric rise in achievements.
Okay, so he's essentially a bit of a Mary Sue, huh? Or rather, I suppose Gary Stu is the correct term. He's Tom Clancy's power fantasy.
Yes, exactly. And I'm somewhat familiar with the term Mary Sue and Gary Stu, but for our audience, what exactly do we mean when we talk about a character who is one?
Well, there's generally a sense that it's a character who is a stand-in for the author. Although I suppose maybe someone can correct me if I'm wrong here, but it can just be a character who is so loved by the author and so favored as their most precious creation ever that that person can do no wrong. Regardless, he or she is drastically overpowered or overly blessed. You know, if it's a guy, women want him and men want to be him. If he's smart, he's brilliant. If he's strong, he's, you know, unrivaled. He or she is just good at everything. And consequently, their adventures just feel like somewhat one note fantasies, as opposed to fully realized characters involved in a more realistic universe. And of course, you often get these sorts of debates sometimes. It's in fandom, it's often an insult or an accusation. This character is a Mary Sue or a Gary Stu. It's just unrealistic how good this person is at everything. For various reasons, you know, the Star Wars fans argued about whether Rey was a Mary Sue in The Force Awakens. And there are so very many other examples, some fair, some not. All of a sudden, I'm struggling to think of a few. Who do you have on the brain?
Well, since I've been rereading Slacktivist's teardowns of the Left Behind novels, those are the examples that jump most obviously to mind of Captain Raymond Steele and journalist Buck.
Oh, yes, yes. Those are painful ones. Good choices.
Those are very painful ones. Yeah, and it's clear as I went back and I reviewed all of the novels that Ryan was in, that Ryan is a bit of a Gary Stu. It's not just that he's always right, it's that he always rises after each novel in ways that are really not all that realistic in terms of what a career path would look like. And yet he just does. He starts out as a CIA analyst. He ends up as a special assistant to the deputy director for intelligence. He ends up being the deputy director of intelligence. Then he ends up being the deputy director of the entire CIA before brokering peace in the Middle East.
You know what's interesting about this, or funny, is that I have seen The Hunt for Red October, the movie adaptation, and I have seen Patriot Games, and I've seen Clear and Present Danger, and all of these films I saw when I was younger, and I don't believe I cottoned to the fact that they were all supposed to feature the same character. Mm. And Harrison Ford's job is only to play Harrison Ford anyway. And so consequently, I really had no problem with this whatsoever. They were all separate characters, and particularly special jobs, played by radically different men in radically different ways. So there was just no clue of this idea that this was all supposed to be one Ubermensch.
Well, and these are the stories, I was actually going to call out those three stories, because those are the stories that are the earliest in Ryan's career, where Ryan is a character who is a brainy guy who knows his way around a gun, actually works, because that's before Ryan's elevation really gets ridiculous. And so in each of these, he's a former Marine. He's trained. He knows how to handle himself in a firefight. But he's essentially an analyst who puts the pieces together and operates that way. And in those are the stories where it really doesn't get ridiculous. And so if that's your main exposure to the character, you really don't see how ridiculous his career arc got later. And it is worth mentioning out, Jack Ryan is a character who was not just popular in the 80s and 90s. Alec Baldwin, of course, played him in the early 90s version of Hunt for Red October, which, if you've seen Hunt for Red October, you know why I love this movie. If you haven't seen Hunt for Red October, you really should. It is one of my favorite movies, hands down. Alec Baldwin playing Jack Ryan does an incredible job, and this was early in Baldwin's career before he became a parody of himself. Alec Baldwin does a tremendous job as Jack Ryan, an analyst who is in over his head and is being swept along by events, just trying to keep his head above water and not get swept under.
Although it's hard to remember such a time. The Hunt for Red October occurred at a point when Alec Baldwin was still a heartthrob, and my wife, as a teen, thought he was extremely attractive, and The Hunt for Red October was one of her favorite movies, not only because of him, of course, but because it was just a really good movie. I really should rewatch that. I don't remember much about it, other than, of course, what the cook does toward the end.
The other thing you should be aware of, if you've never seen Hunt for Red October before, is it stars Sean Connery as a Russian captain of the submarine, and it stars Sam Neill as his executive officer. Now, that's some pairing that really, really, really should not work. A Scotsman playing a Russian with an American also playing a Russian as the... That sounds like a disaster. It should be a train wreck. And yet it's not. It works. After a while, you forget that he's a Russian captain with a Scottish accent, and you just roll with it. Everybody in the film plays their part the way that they should, and the film works even in ways that it shouldn't. Partly because it moves along, partly because the film's creators brought in just enough of the technical detail to make it feel like the book that it was drawn from without burying the movie watcher in too much detail. And I actually watched it about a year ago, and I had reread Hunt for Red October and then watched the movie, kind of deliberately because I wanted to see how well they reflected each other. And the movie is its own thing. There's a lot from the book that's either chopped or really compressed or altered in various ways, and yet the movie feels like the book. It's a really impressive achievement.
Okay, well, look, we've held forth for some time now on Jack Ryan in the past, but how is the new iteration, Joe?
So let's talk about who's in this new iteration, just to see if this draws the reader's interest. The new iteration of Jack Ryan stars Jim Halpert and Bunk.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. The main actor is John Krasinski, who is Jim Halpert on the U.S. version of The Office, a low-key, not all that serious character. And yet he works as Jack Ryan. I did not recognize him. I haven't watched a ton of The Office to begin with, but when I watched the first couple of episodes, I had a vague feeling that perhaps John Krasinski was someone I should know, but it really didn't click for me until I looked it up on IMDb.
Really?
He manages to play a much more buttoned-down, serious, different character. And this may
be it helped that he never once looked at the camera like, I don't believe this is happening, huh?
Exactly.
And never broke the fourth wall with his eyes.
Exactly. He is playing a different character, which is always, I think, impressive when an actor can do that. And then,
especially after being defined by a role for, 7 or 8 years.
Yes, exactly. And then the other main actor is Wendell Pierce, who is Bunk on The Wire. And since I've just finished watching The Wire, that was cool. Seeing him get introduced. He plays the character of James Greer, who Ryan works a good deal with in the first couple of novels.
Now, is that a canon character?
Yes,
okay,
it is.
You just said he was from a couple of novels?
Yep. Yeah, in the books, he was Admiral James Greer, who was deputy director for intelligence of the CIA. In the TV show, he's playing a slightly different role, but still Ryan's superior officer.
Well, obviously, Wendell Pierce is a get no matter where you put him. That man is just extremely charming and a good actor. Before this year, I wouldn't have known what to have made of John Krasinski being in anything else. But he has had a remarkable year. He directed and starred in A Quiet Place this year. I don't know if you saw previews for that. It's this high concept horror movie in which in this post-apocalyptic wasteland, there are these monsters that have killed everybody running around, and they hunt you by hearing you. And so consequently, the whole movie is quiet. Every single sound, every little crunch under the foot, everything is magnified. And the characters almost exclusively speak in sign language. Mm. And it's a taut and very enjoyable thriller. And, you know, he just did a really good job with it and just totally told me that this guy is, you know, the real deal and can do a lot more.
There you go. Yeah, and after seeing this show, I would agree. General plot, the plot did have to be updated. We can't go with Soviet Union, Russia, or Soviet Union-American competition anymore. And so the plot deals with the CIA attempting to track Middle Eastern terrorism and Middle Eastern militant groups. And so that is what Jack Ryan is following and is analyzing for the CIA. But the tone of the show is faithful to the source material. Jack Ryan still is from Boston College. In fact, the first time we see him, he is in a... I'm just going to go with it. He's in a rowboat. You know, one of those fancy ones they use at the Ivy League universities. He's rowing. And in Washington, D.C., wearing a Boston College sweatshirt. So it's obvious from the very beginning this is a guy who went to an Ivy League university and is not ashamed of it.
Okay.
He is an economist. He has worked on Wall Street before. He is a former Marine. And his job in the CIA, going with the economics degree, is in... And as a former Wall Street stockbroker, is in following the money, monitoring bank accounts in the Middle East, monitoring transfers of funds, looking for patterns and seeing what he can figure out from who's sending money to whom and when and in how and what amounts.
Okay, that's interesting.
The key question I had about the show was it going to be more brainy or was it going to be more brawny? Was this going to be Jack Ryan action hero who goes in with guns blazing, or was this going to be Jack Ryan analyst who just happens to see patterns that other people can't and then gets dragged along on an adventure?
Yeah, just a straight up sort of action movie where it's mainly just about someone being faster shot than the other guy seems like a real misappropriation of Tom Clancy as a concept. Which is basically what he is now.
Exactly. And I was a bit worried from the previews I'd seen. It looked like, you know, explosions and stuff. So I was a bit worried we were going to go Jack Ryan action hero. But they're doing a pretty good job of being Jack Ryan analyst. He spots some stuff. He gets dragged along to Yemen. And there is a firefight at a black ops base that he's at. But he himself is not involved in the firefight. He is elsewhere doing other stuff while the firefight is happening. And then he gets dragged along to Paris, and again, there's some action-y stuff that happens, but he's mainly in the background. He is not the one kicking down the door and firing off the automatic weapons. So that I was impressed with. We are keeping him as a smart, intelligent character rather than as an action hero, at least so far in the first three episodes.
I'd like to note that I'm impressed that it addresses Yemen. When you were describing the thrust as a whole Middle East deal, I thought to myself, that's so aughts. You know, it's kind of almost not what we're focused on anymore, because really the international world order with America in the lead just sort of beat to hell the whole Middle Eastern terrorist threat. It seems quite played, but Yemen is actually something that amazingly a lot of the world is still not really thinking about.
And this show is doing a very good job with sympathetic characters. Obviously, the villain is some kind of a Middle Eastern terrorist, but episode one opens in 1983 in Lebanon's Bekaa Valley, which, if you know anything at all about the history of Middle Eastern terrorism, terrorist groups for a while kind of took over the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon and used it for a training ground. And it was where a lot of them hung out and where the U.S. and other countries did their best to root them out from. And so this story opens with two kids in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, and they're playing outside as suddenly a group of aircraft comes screaming overhead, does a banking turn, and then starts flying back towards where they are, dropping bombs the whole way, a rippling, rolling series of explosions. And you don't see until the very end of the first episode what the result of that is. But it's clear that they're setting up. Our villain has a legitimate grudge against either the Americans or an allied European nation, for what happened to him when he was a kid, what he experienced and lived through, which is a side you often don't get in American media and in American press, is exactly how terrifying it can be to live in one of those areas where the U.S. considers it a somewhat free fire zone to go after radical terrorists. And for the people caught in the middle, it's just a horrifying way to live. And that's how episode one opens up, giving you a small dose of that. And then I think it's the second or third episode continues that by you see modern day, a group of kids playing over in the Middle East, and they're laying on the ground, they're laughing and they're giggling, and you're not quite sure what's going on. Mom calls them in to dinner. They get up and they run inside, and she looks over at where they were playing, and they've been using chalk to draw chalk outlines of each other on the patio, which is probably realistic for kids in that area of the world, and as a parent is also a bit horrifying that this is something you see often enough, that level of violence, to where drawing a chalk outline seems like a natural thing for a kid to do. And so this is a show that leans into its subject matter. Yeah, Ryan's trying to stop what looks to be an impending series of terrorist attacks, but the terrorists aren't just one-dimensional bad guys.
Okay. I could groove to that. I'll have to watch it. I am very much, I don't even know what my own reaction is generally going to be to this sort of film anymore. Whether I'm just going to sit down and suddenly start feeling like, oh, this is just imperialist apologism, you know, or whether I'm going to think, well, this is a very moderate view and, you know, I'm liking this. It's fairly even keeled and you can see what's going on and kind of extract your own thoughts and whatnot. I tend to be a little schizophrenic.
Yeah,
but I'm interested.
This is a show that is smart. We in later episodes get drone warfare, and we see the drone warfare operators and the psychological cost on them of piloting a drone 24 hours, or 12 hours a day. And the thing about drone warfare is, there are very, very, very good cameras attached to these drones. So when you are piloting a drone, you essentially have a god's eye view of the world. And you're not just bombing abstract targets. You can see the person riding the motorbike that you are about to drop a bomb on top of. And then you drop the bomb and you see the explosion. And you see, you know, the bike and the body flying through the air. Piloting one of these drones is legitimately a traumatic experience. It's one of the big problems that the Air Force and the Army have, is having sufficient drone pilots to rotate through when your drone pilots get burned out from the amount of death and devastation that they're dealing on a daily basis. And the show leans into that and shows it. And so it's not quite as educational in terms of the technology as the original novels were, but I think it's perhaps even more educational in terms of giving you a view of what warfare is really like and the effects that it really has.
Well, that's an interesting difference between prose and film. You know, usually film has the advantage in so many ways, but it's much more difficult to explain, I would think, to explain how things work and keep the plot moving,
right,
than it would be for a prose novelist, you know, to keep that sense of propulsion. And so I can see that, how if you couldn't spend a lot of time trying to explain the mechanics of drones and, you know, what makes for a good drone strike or a good drone pilot as opposed to what makes for a bad drone pilot, then what you would want to tack to is, you know, something else, you know, or something else that your audience probably hasn't extrapolated from the whole concept of drone warfare, such as the psychological toll that watching people die through really good cameras 12 hours a day takes on a drone pilot.
Right, absolutely. And that's where I like this show, because it's not trying to be exactly what the Tom Clancy novels were. It's not even necessarily trying to be what the various movies based on the Tom Clancy novels were. But it is leaning into the Clancy novels were educational. Ryan is a brainy character, to where we've got Ryan is a brainy character and a TV show that is educating the audience about aspects of the U.S. war on terror that probably a large portion of them are not aware of.
Okay. Yeah. You know, if you're, as long as you're showing me something, you know, there are many different ways to be educated. So I like that. So, I guess this definitely has you interested. You're sticking with it.
Yeah, I'm definitely sticking with it. You know, I've got nits to pick with the show. It's a little bit formulaic the way Jack Ryan and James Greer meet each other. You can tell a mile away exactly what's happening as soon as you see the two of them on screen together.
Oh God, they're falling in love? That's different.
Not quite, but also you can kind of see it going that way. The two people who hate each other on first sight and who you're convinced by the end of the season are going to be buddy cops together.
Okay. Sure. The old Lethal Weapon setup.
Exactly. So it's definitely formulaic in spots, but it's interesting in enough other spots that I'm going to stick with it and see where the story goes.
Okay. Well, I was interested when I saw it. And of course, the streaming service has been pushing it pretty heavily. I don't actually have a subscription, which must mean that its marketing department is really pulling out all the stops, because otherwise, how would I have noticed it? It's on Hulu, right?
Amazon Prime. And it's interesting, Amazon tracks the success of its shows by how many people sign up and then a given show is the first thing that they watch. So essentially, how many shows drive people to show up. And so if this is something that causes you to go, huh, I should get Amazon Prime for a year, because, I mean, free shipping plus videos, why not? And you do it to watch this show, that is going to go directly into Amazon's metrics of, hey, we've got a hit on our hands that's doing what it's supposed to.
Really? How did you even happen on this particular little bit of corporate trivia? Because Netflix does its absolute best to keep their metric systems, you know, secret.
It was something that popped up, I think, on one of the tech sites I was reading, somewhere in the intersection of tech and business, that yeah, Amazon runs Amazon Prime Video as a way to get you to sign up for Amazon Prime, and not just the video, but everything else it offers. And it very much evaluates shows on how well they do at sucking people in.
That's interesting. Also, Amazon Prime. Okay, I do have Amazon, actually. I think I can totally watch that. I thought it was on Hulu for God knows what reason.
No, as long as you've got an Amazon Prime membership, you can fire up the app, log in, and enjoy yourself. And I think you will enjoy yourself.
Okay, well, I think I'm interested enough to give it at least one episode. Any final thoughts about it?
I would say that for me, the second episode is maybe even more than the first episode where it kicks. This is a show that, I guess, last thought, it's very episodic. You know, we talked about The Wire being more like chapters in a book, and having a very different feel. This is very much a traditional show, and it is very episodic. The first episode is all about setting up who everyone is, doing introductions, putting the pieces into place on the board, and then the second episode is kind of where the real story starts and you start seeing connections come together. So I would say give it two episodes. And if you don't like it after two, don't give it any more. But if you're a little bit uncertain after one, definitely give it that second one.
Huh. That's interesting from a streaming service.
It's an interesting show in a lot of ways. I'm very eager to see the rest of it and see where it ends up.
All right. Well, you heard it here first, and if that sounds like something that would interest you, give Jack Ryan a shot on Amazon Prime. And if you haven't ordered it yet, or if you haven't signed up for Amazon Prime yet, be aware that by doing so, you are encouraging Amazon to continue to develop the series.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to The Golden Age and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Just go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to The Golden Age, and rate it. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following at FromVoxDuo on Twitter. Joe blogs at MinorThoughts.com and is on Twitter at JMartinDF. Adam is on Twitter as well, at Adam Volle. That's Adam, V-O-L-L-E.
Yeah, I was taking a look at the amount of notes you had on Dragon Con and the massive amount of notes I had on Jack Ryan, and I thought I could edit myself. I could keep myself in check and make this short, but I don't think that's going to happen. Well, to be fair, that I copied out of Wikipedia. I did not write that up on my own. Wikipedia is a wonderful resource when you're putting together a show on a deadline.